Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to another great Saturday we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. We have a great show for you today. Four fantastic authors. We're going to kick it off with New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry, followed by Marcia Clark, Paul Parsons, and Haywood Gould will be coming up. So sit back, relax, enjoy, because 2 hours of Suspense Radio starts right now. Again, everybody, welcome back here to this great Saturday we have of Suspense Radio. So good to be back with you after a couple weeks off. Remember, we are going to have another couple weeks off because we're going to Thriller Fest and we're going to be on vacation. And then we'll be back. Check out the website for a lot more information on shows and things that we have coming up. We have a lot of them booked. So check out the magazine site, suspensemagazine.com. Click on Suspense Radio to find out more about that. But we're going to jump right in here to our first guest. We're so pleased to have him back on. It's always gracious. We were able to speak with him here. His tour had just ended last week, so we're catching him outside of the range of that. So, author Steve Barry, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing today?
Doing great. A little tired. Been 3 weeks on the road.
Yeah. I can kind of hear your voice a little bit, but it's all, you know, it's so nice of you to be able to come on after this to be able to talk about your latest book, number 8, Cotton Malone series, The King's Deception. Can you give us a little behind the scenes, maybe like what's not on the book cover, about what Cotton has kind of gotten himself into this time?
He's gotten himself into something very interesting. I came across it 3 years ago when I was in England in a little village north of London, and a lady there told me about something that happened in the village of Bisley for about 300 years. For 300 years, they would take a young boy, dress him up in Elizabethan, female Elizabethan costume, and parade him through the streets. Now, this is a very odd thing to do, and as I began to look into it even more, I discovered that Bram Stoker had also come across this in the early part of the 20th century and wrote about it in a book called The Famous Imposters. And as I looked at it even more, I learned more about what's called the Bisley Boy legend, and it involves the occurrence that at age 13, the young Princess Elizabeth lived in Bisley. She got fever, died, and was buried there. Her governess, Lady Ashley, replaced Elizabeth with a young boy who was Henry VIII's illegitimate grandson, and that young boy went on to become Queen of England and ruled for 45 years. That's the Bisley Boy legend. So I've woven that into a modern-day thriller with Cotton Malone.
And then you also did something a little bit different, too. Because the last three books, what you've done is you're able to put together a novella, and this novella that you have out, The Tudors, is the Tudor pilot or plot. Is that something that you should be read maybe before or kind of after? How does that kind of weave itself within the book, The King's Deception?
It's just a little bonus piece that we put out as a way to stimulate pre-orders. If you read the book and then you read the short story, you're fine. If you read the short story, read the book. Or if you don't read the short story at all, it wouldn't matter. It's just a little bonus material we created that kind of fits in a place. You'll get it once you read the novel. It's a way to stimulate pre-orders. And it was all also a way to get more interest in the Tudors. I mean, this whole thing revolves around Elizabeth the First, and this was a very strange lady. If she was a lady at all her life she wore wigs. All her life she wore heavy face paint. All her life she wore clothes that didn't flatter her body. She refused to allow doctors to examine her. When she died, she left orders that her body was not to be examined or autopsied and was to be sealed away, and it was. Her number one duty as queen was to have an heir, yet she refused to marry, refused to have a child, and called herself the Virgin Queen. And then the strangest of all, when she dies, they bury her and her sister Mary in the same grave so their bones would mingle together. And that's what it says on the tomb. Now, all of that points to something very suspicious, something very interesting. And this raises up this whole thing of this Bisley boy legend. It's a fascinating thing from English history that I stumbled across that makes for a really good thriller.
And so when you go back and you hear these stories and you're in England and this woman is kind of telling you this, how much of it do you believe is maybe kind of more myth? And then when you start getting involved more into it, you kind of see how the story kind of unravels itself and realize this is something that Cotton Malone needs to explore further within the book.
Well, when I first heard it, I thought she was crazy. I didn't really do it. Then when I read when I read Stoker's account, I said, well, wait a minute now, something here. And then as I studied Elizabeth, I read like 300 to 400 books on Elizabeth, I began to realize how little we know of this person. You know, you may say, well, we've got paintings of her. We know exactly what she looks like. No, you don't. Prior to the age of 25, there are no images of Elizabeth. After the age of 25, when she became queen, she controlled her image and she imposed what's called the mask of youth. You did not paint Elizabeth the way you wanted to paint her. You painted her the way she told you to paint her. So we have absolutely no idea what this person looked like. And as I began to study all of this and see all of these very questionable things about her, it began to make, you know, kind of sense that this could very well have been an imposter.
And when you look back in English lore and English history, what's more like the consensus? I mean, I'm sure most everybody believes that she's probably a woman, but then you have the people on the other side that they, you know, not so fast, not so quick. And is it something that will ever be figured out?
Well, here's the thing. What does it matter if she's a woman? You know, you would say, well, who cares? It was 400 years ago. Well, actually, it matters a great deal. And here's the real kicker of this. This is the very first so what I've ever had in a novel that has absolute dire consequences in our real world. You see, Elizabeth is the one who seized all the land in Northern Ireland and took the land from the Catholics and gave it to the Protestants. Her successor, James, who she named, also finished that. Now, here's the thing. If Elizabeth is a fraud, all of those land titles are fraud. And if they're a fraud, you've got chaos in Northern Ireland because the fight there is about the land seizures. That's really where it all started, is when that happened. So this was so explosive of an issue, my British publisher required that I tone the book down a little bit. They said, you can't really be in your face with this too much. We got to tone this down. And I actually had to write the book in a little bit different way than I normally would have because of this and the potential for explosiveness from it.
And, you know, you've also won together, you know, Libyan terrorists, which, of course, is big time in the news now, you know, with Libya and everything that's kind of going on and into that realm. What was kind of like your thinking behind, you know, this is how, you know, Gary, his son, kind of disappears, and you kind of have all these things going at such a fast pace.
What's happening?
You would just take all that lore, and put it all kind of together, you know, when you wrote it.
Well, it's a modern-day thriller. It's a geopolitical battle between the United States and Great Britain. The United States wants Great Britain to intervene and stop the release of this Libyan terrorist, who we all know a few years ago that's what happened, and the book is set then. Mm-hmm. And the British refuse to intervene. We're looking for something to force them to intervene. And this secret from their past a way to blackmail them into doing it is what the CIA is after. And the Brits are trying to stop this from being revealed. And Cotton gets caught up in the middle of this. Cotton and Gary get caught up in this by accident and are drawn into it. And so it's a modern-day geopolitical thriller with this great historical hook to it. But it's also a father-son story between Gary and Cotton as we resolve this conflict between them. And there's a father-son story between Henry VIII and his offspring. And it's a father-son story between Ian Dunn, the young street kid who's at the center of this, who has no father and has to wrestle with that as well. So that's part of what I did. This, you know, I have to have this modern thriller, but this historical hook, everything turns on whether it's true or not. And I have to say, from spending about a year with it, it is not beyond the realm of possibility that it could well be true.
Yeah, and is that something that, you know, do you feel like a little bit scared, like when you start writing this? Not, I don't know if scared is the right word, but something like you just said, like, wow, this really could be true. And, you know, what have I kind of stumbled upon? You know, how does that kind of make you feel kind of when you finish the book and you always, you know, you're one of the authors that reads their books numerous times to make sure everything kind of gets correct. How does it make you feel when you finish it out and then you kind of sit back and actually take it all in on what you wrote?
It was pretty interesting here because as I looked into it more and more, I became more and more convinced. And there's an easy way to prove or disprove this, by the way. Just open Elizabeth's grave. The grave has been sealed for 400 years. It's one of the few royal tombs never breached, not even during the English Civil War when they were desecrating tombs. This tomb is sealed. It'd be very fascinating to find out what's inside there. You know, there's a 40-year-old woman in there, Mary, but is there a 70-year-old woman? Is there a 70-year-old man? Is there a 13-year-old girl? We don't quite know what's in there, so it'd be interesting to open it up. But just imagine the implications if you opened it and there was a 70-year-old female, 70-year-old male skeleton in there with Mary. I mean, you could have real problems in Northern Ireland, so significant problems at this point, because it's elementary land real estate law that a title to property has to be clean all the way back to its source. And in this case, it would not be clean at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's always the most intriguing parts here about your books is the realism that you always bring to the fiction and how you kind of wind it together. And the other thing is that you always have very intriguing characters that you kind of introduce, and you're very thought out in how you bring these characters in. And which one of the, you know, which character or two kind of surprised you in The King's Deception by maybe having a higher voice than you thought maybe they would when you started writing the book?
Well, the two twins do, the elderly twins, Miss Mary and her sister. They were going to be kind of little bit players, and as I began to develop them and play with them, they became much more prevalent. So they have a very interesting role in this. The two twins do, and Tanya and Miss Mary are fun. They were a lot of fun to work with, and I had a good time with them. Their role definitely got expanded as I began to become more acquainted with them. I enjoyed both characters immensely. Kathleen Richards is an interesting character, the female SOCA agent that's involved in this, who is kind of a loose cannon on the deck, who gets hooked up with Malone here. And Blake Antrim, the antagonist, who has a connection to Malone, and Malone doesn't realize it until we're really late into this. You know, and as I said, Gary, who's got to deal with this whole thing of what a father is. Is a father someone who plants the seed, or is a father much more than that? Is there more to it? And so he has to deal with that. He has to come to some realizations and make some very adult decisions for a 16-year-old. So there's a lot of characters in this story woven around this historical secret.
And again, we are speaking here with New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry. The latest book is The King's Deception, which is out now, and you know it's the book 8 in the Cotton Malone series. And when you look at Cotton and Gary's relationship, and it's something that you kind of build up and then you kind of tried to answer, do you feel that you answered the questions and made it so where your readers, when they read this, they kind of have a sense of, they know kind of where the relationship might be headed before you maybe crack it again in the next one and just throw everything into a tizzy?
No, what I did is this was a resolution of Cotton. And by the way, you don't have to read the Cotton Malone books in any order. I write them where you can come in and out anywhere. I've had people read the series backwards. You can do it. I do that on purpose. So, you know, if you don't know about Cotton and Gary's relationship, you'll learn all about it in this book. There's nothing you will miss. It's all there. But I also resolve it here, too. So that issue's kind of over, and they'll move on now mm-hmm. to something else and be done with it. But this was a book about resolving Gary and Cotton's conflict between them. But as I said, don't feel daunted if you're coming into the series now. The books are written pretty much to stand alone, and you won't have any trouble knowing exactly what's going on.
Yeah, and that's always the good thing, too, because you can go back because of all the books. You know, you had the Columbus Affair before that, and then the Jefferson Key. And then the one thing that, like we talked about at the beginning, that you have started to do is, you know, with the Devil's Gold, which is part of, like, the Emperor's Tomb and the Admiral's Mark, and which all ties in here to your series, how that been? I mean, how much fun kind of you've been able to be able to kind of roll Cotton now into this giant, you know, character now that you have, you know, like his dossier on board and everything else. And now he's, you know, he's almost becoming more and more like a real person outside the pages.
Yeah, he's catching on, and that's what happens after you get to about book 8, 9, or 10. And it begins to – the character becomes familiar, and people begin to really identify with it, and it's been gratifying. But that was certainly the goal. We were hoping that would happen, and it seems to be happening now. And so, you know, Cotton's going to be around for the next four books, so you're going to get a lot more from him and learn some more about him. He's growing. He's changing. He's not the same guy he was in the Templar Legacy. He's a little bit evolved, and he's continuing to evolve as he discovers things about himself. And that's what you want. You want your characters to evolve.
And when you say, like, the next four books, are they going to be more along the lines of going, you know, like year by year, kind of, you know, Gary's now kind of 16, moving into 17, 18. Are you going to jump a little bit? How do you kind of see the series headed into the future?
No, I had to stop the aging process. If you keep the aging process going, we're going to run out of years. So, yeah, Cotton has kind of locked in around 47 now. I let Gary slip up to about 16. So Gary may grow. Gary may age a little bit more, but Cotton's going to kind of stay kind of locked in. And you really have to do that at some point in the series if it's going to catch on and stay. You know, it's like Dirk Pitt. You know, that series is 40 years old, and Dirk Pitt's the same age he always was, and he has two grown children now for some reason. It's just what you have to accept to keep a series going. There's no way that you can allow these folks to continue to age. So I had to slow that process down because I want him to stay around a while.
Yeah, it's always been kind of a little funky dynamic where you kind of had to do that, but you had to bring other things kind of up, and you know you're bringing in a lot of new real world events and things like that. Is something coming up in the next four books that, you know, some kind of mystery, some kind of historical background that has already surprised you, and are you taking him to a different part of the world that he's never been before?
No, next year he's going to come back home for a domestic adventure again, at one that I've been wanting to do for some time. It's really something really cool. I can't tell you what it's about, but I can tell you the title, which may give you an idea of what it's about. It's called The Lincoln Myth, and it's going to deal something with Abraham Lincoln, something very interesting with Abraham Lincoln that Cotton's going to get caught up in, and something from the Constitution again that's very interesting that should surprise a lot of readers again from our Constitution. So that one's finished. You stay a year ahead in the book business, so I'm starting Cotton's adventure that'll be for 2015, and that'll be another interesting international adventure for him.
And we always have a lot of authors that listen to the show, a lot of people that, you know, we have that are going to Thriller Fest, and you're going to be predominantly there in Thriller Fest doing a lot of things in Craft Fest. What do you have planned on the docket for Thriller Fest? You know, can fans, you know, are you going to be teaching anything or anything else going on?
Yeah, I'm teaching on Wednesday morning. I always teach the bonus session Wednesday morning before Craft Fest begins at noontime. I teach the 2 hours Wednesday morning. I'll be teaching story structure, point of view, dialogue, a class that I've taught every year, and it seems to be popular and people like it, so they asked me to do it again. I'll be doing a couple of panels on Friday. And then Saturday morning, I'm speaking at the debut author's breakfast, because Saturday evening they're giving me the Silver Bullet Award, which is the ITW's award for philanthropic work. And I got picked for it this year because of our History Matters Foundation. So it's very nice, very honored that I get that. So I'll be having, and then something really cool Saturday morning, Elizabeth and I are being interviewed together by MJ Rose. They're doing a joint interview of me and Elizabeth that'll be there. So it's going to be a great week. Anyone who's never been to Thriller Fest, you certainly, it's amazing. You're going to have about 1,000 people there. About 300 to 400 of the biggest writers in the business. We have agents, press. We're getting more and more fans. We have something really cool on Friday night called Fan Fest this year, where 12 of my the writers have paid for the privilege to have 12 fans come. So I'm having 12 of my fans who we selected through my web for my Facebook page are coming, and there's about 20 or 25 other writers, and we're having Fan Fest. Now, if you're registered for Thriller Fest, you can come to Fan Fest too. So if you're there, you ought to come by Friday night to Fan Fest. It's going to be the first time we've done that, and it's going to be quite fun for these select fans of each writer who will be there. So Thriller Fest is really interesting. They can find out all about it, you know, on the website at, I think it's thrillerfest.com. It's all there.
Yeah, and that's the one thing, because we heard about Fan Fest, and I thought that was a really cool idea, because you guys always kind of add something every year to the event, you know, with Craft Fest and Thriller Fest, Agent Fest. There's always something new that's going on in Fan Fest this year. It sounded like, you know, it was a terrific idea. So, you know, you'd be able to walk around and just kind of mingle with a bunch of different authors into a, just basically a very, you know, less stressful situation, very, very easy going. Walk up and talk to anybody you want.
That's the way Thriller Fest is. It's fairly open. It's very easy to get to everybody. It's the gathering of the genre, and if anybody's a thriller junkie, this is a place to be. You know, 4 days in New York where we kind of have summer camp for thriller writers and thriller enthusiasts.
And you mentioned your History Matters project. Now, what if somebody, you know, listening to the show or gets on, you know, gets involved and wants to know more about History Matters? Can they kind of volunteer? Can they get involved? How can they do something in their hometown if they see something kind of falling to the wayside and they maybe want you to try to help them get in, you know, help them with their historical, you know, buildings or something that are being taken away from them?
Well, we work with groups and communities, so the local historical societies, the local, you know, any organized group can get in touch with us, and we'll help put together a History Matters project to come to their town and help raise money. We've done about 60 projects around the country. We've raised around $600,000 for various historic preservation efforts. So they can go to my website, steveberry.org, go to the History Matters section, send us an email, and we'll see if we can come and help you out.
Yeah, I mean, it's always a fabulous thing that you guys do, you and Elizabeth, and it's always great to be able to talk with you. And we want to thank you again so much for coming on. We know after your tour here, you're kind of winding down, and you got Thriller Fest coming up in like a week and a half, and you want to be able to kind of take a break. So, Steve, it's always great to talk with you and about your latest book, The King's Deception. Thank you so much for coming on, and, you know, we will see you in a couple weeks.
Thank you. I'll see you at Thriller Fest.
All right. Bye-bye, Steve. Enjoy.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is New York Times bestselling author Steve Berry with his latest book, The King's Deception, number 8 in the Cotton Malone series. Go to steveberry.org to find out a bunch of information that you want. He has a lot of free stuff up there, a lot of information about his books, about Cotton Malone, about everything that he has going on. And like he said, you can find out more about History Matters if that is something that you are dealing with in your town. It's a fabulous organization, and I highly suggest that if something happens, you need something, you know, contact them and see what they can do for you. So we have a lot of things happening here, like we said. I'm going to go over really fast here with the before our next guest. Let me take a little bit of a break for the radio show, because it is going to be a little bit off here for the next couple of weeks. But we have some great authors coming up. And do not forget about our Suspense Radio one-on-one interviews, which we've now partnered up with Partners in Crime Tours, and we have about 6 authors that are lined up, and we do those shows on random Sunday mornings during their tour at 10 a.m. where you can hear them, you know, one-on-one about their book, part of the tour stop. And, you know, we've been able to kind of, you know, anybody who does Partners in Crime, they kind of get their own little tour stop here. So, but July 27th is going to be our next show, and then July 28th will be our next one-on-one. And then we move here into August. We do have some exciting news that we will have James Patterson coming on the show sometime soon. We're going to have him last Friday, Things Happen, and we're going to have him coming up in the show, and he's going to be featured in our November magazine. So that's going to be fabulous, too. You'll be able to see James Patterson for the first time. We've been able to speak with him, so we're very excited about that. Some of the other things that we got coming up here is the segment is also talked about or sponsored with Simon & Schuster. And when you visit a place where trash mingles with trash and death is waiting, you want to read West Palm by Joss Cordero. It's a four-part serialized ebook from Pocket Star, and you can download West Palm today. If you go to our website, you'll see the link for it. You can click on it and take it right over there and check out that new book called West Palm. So we're going to take a quick break here before our next guest comes on. That is author Marcia Clark. You also might know Marcia from, she was the lead prosecuting attorney on the O.J. Simpson trial back in 94-95. And she is now with book three in her Rachel Knight series. And this plot is something that is very close to her heart. And we're going to let her explain that to you right when we get back. So until then.
Hello.
welcome back, everybody, out of the break. Again, we want to thank author Steve Barry for coming on to talk about his book, The King's Deception. And now we are going to roll over into our next guest. She is the author of the Rachel Knight series, author Marcia Clark. This is now book three, called Killer Ambition. And we want to thank Marcia for coming on. So how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing fabulous. And again, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It was great to see you at the LA Times Book Festival to kind of get this ball rolling here with the Rachel Knight series. You've now become a summer staple with your books coming out. So it's always great to know that right around the end of June, July, that another Rachel Knight book is headed our way.
Yay! Yay! And
yeah.
I really like, I like being able to provide like a fun beach read kind of book. I mean, it's got a little more gravity than that, but not a ton. And I like, it's like, you know, great fun to deliver murder mysteries and stories that have also a lot of fun going on between the women that are best friends. So you get kind of this buddy cop kind of setup. So you have the humor along with the serious of the crime.
And this plot in Killer Ambition is something you know just a little bit about. Rachel kind of finds herself in a high-profile court case. And I have to think that, you know, it was kind of, you kind of had to take yourself back, what, gosh, it's been 94, 95 now, back into that time when you were thrust into it. So how were the, you know, did you have any kind of emotion kind of going on when you started writing about a plot that was something that was so close to you?
You know, I did. It's funny because when I sat down to write book three, this is like the third one in the series, I didn't think about whether I was going to do a courtroom drama or what kind. I just kind of came up with this story, and one thing led to another, and I realized that the story itself was something that should not only just, the other two books are just really investigation stories, and they end with the arrest. This one, mm-hmm. I thought, as I was writing, I realized, you know what, I got to go to trial. This one really has to go the whole distance, and so it wound up, and the kind of case it was a high-profile case. So, you know what I mean? It was organic, and it was logical that it would be like that. So I wound up having to kind of plumb my own experience. And some of that was really fun. Some of it was really painful. And I tried to take out the most painful parts of what I went through or mute them because that's not fun. But some of it you certainly get. Rachel does get a personal hard way to go because there's so much interest in the case that the players involved become fodder for tabloids and stuff, which really does happen and really did happen. So I really did plumb a lot of personal experience for it.
Well, can you give us a little bit of like what kind of case that you kind of threw Rachel into this time that might not be kind of on the back cover that fans will kind of, you know, want to know a little bit more about from your point of view?
Well, what it starts out with, the setup is, which they would know from the back cover, and I'll take off from there, is that the daughter of a very wealthy, famous megastar director, think Steven Spielberg, James Cameron, that level, is abducted. And Bailey catches the case, and Rachel jumps in with her because she's going to wind up on the case anyway. And they go out to the house. They meet with the power player director and his ex-wife. And I describe the entourage and the ins and outs of kind of a Hollywood existence that I think is so different from what most people live with the mega the mega rich, particularly in Hollywood, who have assistants to put for their assistants and people that come and replace the flowers in the foyer and all over the house every day, and just a whole different way of life. So I had the chance to describe that kind of life, as well as the attitudes it brings, and then also, of course, the attitude of the media towards a situation like this, how they cover a case in terms of showing kind of like the way they really do, which is they make it into a horse race, the up and down of every day in trial. Every day somebody won or lost. No, that's not the case, but that is what gets the ratings. And talk about the impact on the trial, the impact on the witnesses, on the judge, the way everybody kind of panders to the press, and show the stress and the toll it takes on all the players. At the same time, their life goes on and how they deal with that. but how the case goes. The roller coaster of a trial really is true. I mean, a trial, no matter how high profile or low profile, there are invariably highs and lows that are unanticipated. Of course, when it's a high profile case, it's more so. So I'm able to take them on that kind of feeling of the nail biter of, oh my God, now what? When things
right.
that are unexpected pop out and witnesses do what they shouldn't be doing.
And, you know, a lot of people always say, and I'm kind of a believer in this too, is that book three is kind of like the breakout book. It's kind of like the one that is like the most emotional in the series already. It's kind of the one where you know, starting to change, you know, Rachel's character and things maybe happening to her more emotionally at a personal level besides the case. Is that something that you made me a conscious effort to do? Because I think that this is more of the most emotional book that Rachel's had to go through. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, it's really kind of, John, a progression of the characters. Rachel starts out in book one dimly understanding her own motivation. She's, as we introduce it in book one, develop in each book a little more, suffered a huge trauma when she was a child. Her older sister, Romy, was abducted. Rachel at that time was 6 years old. And she was abducted. She has still not been found some 20-something years later. She's disappeared. She has not turned up dead. And so Rachel has this constant hope that she will be found at some point. But she has enormous survivor's guilt. Her whole family kind of went into a tailspin and collapsed as a result of Romy's disappearance, which, you know, victims, crime victims, their families frequently do have all kinds of trauma and ongoing issues as a result of the either death or disappearance of a family member. They don't walk away and just somehow recover and pick up all the pieces. Very frequently they do fall apart. And that's what happened to Rachel. She and her mother eventually do recover, but it has a lasting impression on her. Those scars cause her to have difficulties with interpersonal relationships because she has a hard time trusting. She's very guarded, and she was that. She kind of lived a weird existence after Romy was abducted because she was that weird girl whose sister got taken, and she lived in a small
right.
community where she could never escape that. As a result, she becomes a much more guarded, private person, very somewhat even suspicious of others. She's careful about who she lets in. And that causes her problems. In book two, it caused a problem with her relationship with Graydon, her boyfriend, the lieutenant at robbery homicide. It causes her, it did cause her to have a distance between her and her best friends, Tony LaColette, another special trials prosecutor, and Detective Bailey Keller. The three women are very close, but they wind up getting much closer as Rachel discovers she can trust them and be herself. And so Rachel has a growing awareness of who she is, what her problems are, and what those problems, what her childhood trauma is doing to her her adult life. And as she becomes aware of it, the reader discovers with her what is the impact of these problems and how does she deal with them. So I think in each successive book, there's going to be another layer of the onion peeled back, and that's what happened in Killer Ambition, is another layer of the onion got peeled back to show more of her awareness of how the trauma of her childhood affects her now and also drives her in terms of her job. She has such survivor's guilt that she is wedded to justice in a way that's very personal and very emotional to her. It's very much a part of her. And that devotion to justice, to bringing justice to others that she couldn't bring for her own sister and family, drives her to be that much more almost reckless in her pursuit of justice for others in the cases that she takes on. So that explains in a way the reason why she does things that you'd say, oh my God, that's like so over the top, or she pushes really hard, she works really hard, she drives herself to a point that's almost a breaking point because of that. And she's starting to become aware of that as well, and in each book you'll see a little more of it.
Yeah, and just from hearing you talk about, I mean, you can so, and readers should just understand that you have such a grasp of your character, which is something that people say, oh, well, they should because they're writing it, but that's not easy to have. And is that something that while you were working with book one and going through, because you've never worked in fiction before, that you kind of learned that about yourself, that you have to have that grasp around your character, so while you are making the plots go on and on, the character has to kind of come on emotionally with Rachel being at the forefront and the secondary ones all kind of supporting her. That's something that, you know, did you learn that while you were starting with you know, back in the very first beginning of the series?
Yes, it's really true, John. It's such a great point that you're making. Your character has to be real to you. Your character has to be really developed, and you have to figure out how are you going to share the character with the audience in a way that is true to the character. So when I thought of Rachel and who she was, I thought, okay, this is a very scarred person. She's funny. She has fun. She's not grim. She's kind of a tough survivor who is resilient enough to get over what she's been through. She doesn't let it knock her down. Nevertheless, she has a limp. An emotional limp, if you will. Okay, but that person is not going to open up in book one and tell you everything about herself. First of all, she's not all that in touch with it herself. She has to come to grips with the realities of her psyche, her own issues. But she's also somebody who would be very slow to get to let you in. If you meet her, you like her, she's fun, but there's a limit to how much she shares with you because that's her life. She's careful. And so I realized that in book one, I'm going to tell you this much. In book two, how much more would she say? And actually in book two, in Guilt by Degrees, her hand is forced. I have an external circumstance happen that forces her to talk about herself to her best friends in ways that she never wanted to. She has to reveal herself. And then in book three, of course, a little bit more. And so that's the nature of the character. She's not one of those people you meet at a party who says, you know, and then when I was in junior high, and then my boyfriend broke up with me, you know. She's not that person.
Right.
So you have to be true to your character in all ways, not just the way she reacts in the current time, but also the way in which she shares herself or comes on to herself or is aware of what her issues are.
Now, in the new magazine that we have coming out here for July, I did something on the letter from the editor that was a little different because I was talking about the villains, and I was talking about, like, what makes a good villain, because the villain, of course, is the one part that, you know, you tie them to the hero, and it kind of, you know, it's kind of how they move forward along and figuring things out. So what is your thought process when you sit down and you're like, okay, I need to have this villain in this book? How do you go about maybe creating them? And because you have to make them from scratch every single time, so you have to keep creating the dough when nothing is in front of you. So what is your thought process on how you do that?
Create the villains?
Yeah, how do you create? Yeah, like when you sit down and you're thinking, like, what do you kind of start with to say, okay, I need to have a villain in this case that I'm going to be working on. How do you kind of work that, you know, work them together?
When it comes to a villain, that's kind of like, you know, for each individual story, I think that's one of the first things that I think about. Who do I want to talk about? And what do I want to say about that? What do I want the story to revolve around? You know, if you know what I mean? When I think about, the first thing you have to do is, who's your antagonist? Who is she up against? Who is Rachel going to beat down now? And what is the story that I want to tell? You know, when I thought about the story for Killer Ambition, I thought, okay, this is going to be a fun, I want to do a Hollywood story. I want to talk about Hollywood insiders. Okay, so who's going to be the bad guy? Who's the most fun bad guy that makes sense? And that's when I came up with the person that I did, the power player in Hollywood that I did, because it gives me the opportunity it gives me the opportunity to talk about somebody who has all the attributes I want. I don't want to give away too much. But yeah, I think about the story, the kind of story I want to tell, and who do I want Rachel to fight with. and that informs part of the way the story unfolds. So I think that's a matter of inspiration, but it's like, okay, this time I want, like in Guilt by Degrees, I want her to deal with a female sociopath. And by that I mean, I think that the serial killer kind of genre, for me, is kind of played out. And I think I hope to never go there. You never know. And with the minute you say never, of course, that's what you do. But I don't.
Right.
I don't really want to. And I wanted to tell the truth about, in a weird fictional way, about what a sociopath really is. The conscience-free, kind of all-about-myself, narcissistic personality that just is willing to do whatever it takes to get what they want. They just don't care who they trample over. It doesn't necessarily mean they're out for bloodlust. They're out to kill all the time, which people sometimes have that misimpression. So that was the inspiration for kind of most of the story. So in a way, I think of the villain first and then build out from there.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing that when you're looking at villains and you're looking at the creation of them, that you want to make them evil to be hated, but not too evil where they're like just evil, I guess you want.
Yeah.
You know, you got to have
yeah.
the balance in who you're doing, and that's the one thing that, you know, you've done so well, is you've been able to kind of balance Rachel and throughout the series and who she comes up against, with making the criminal and making the case kind of all about, you know, both of them together, but moving them along correctly, I guess, if you want to say.
Yeah, you know, and that's you make a really good point. It's really important to me to make your villains human. What is always off-putting is when you have, not off-putting, but, you know, it is less compelling, let's put it that way. It's when you have these villains who are just all dark, and they're horrible, and they're just monsters, and that, you know, they rape and pillage the countryside. And you know, there are books where, you know, that can work depending on the kind of story you're telling, but for the most part, usually, what's most compelling is a villain who is somewhat sympathetic. Somebody who you go, oh, I kind of get why they wound up like this. You can see that they've been through some things in their lives, and perhaps you personally, John, would not have turned into quite as criminal as they did, but those factors in their lives that turned them would turn anybody to a certain degree, not as much as them, but to a certain degree. And so that makes them more relatable. It's always more interesting when you have that kind of nuance, to me, to your villain.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that's always been, like, you know, really intriguing to me, is when I start reading books, is I always kind of look at the dynamic and see how the two kind of work together, because I think it has to be a harmony. And I think that that's always makes it important to me when I read, that I feel that harmony between them, because they kind of have to be connected in some way. Even if it's just kind of a weird connection, there has to be something there, instead of just throwing somebody out there to just say, go catch them and go do whatever you want to do with them. So that's
yeah.
what I've always, you know, yeah. And so
yeah,
now,
really,
you mentioned, you know, and with Killer Ambition, you take it into the court this time. So you decided to kind of show the reader the courtroom. So how real kind of, you know, did you want to get with them? Because you have to make it interesting, because if people watch court TV and a lot of the court cases, a lot of the stuff is extremely tedious that you guys have to go through. It's not Law and Order, all solved in 30 minutes. So how was that for you to be able to kind of bring that into that? Because, you know, what kind of is real and what kind of is not real, that the reader would always like to know when they're reading into those courtroom scenes?
Yeah, you know, you have to make choices. I mean, the heaven and the hell of having actually done the job of a prosecutor for so many years and defense attorney is that I know how it really goes. Knowing how it really goes means you have almost too much information. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I know that actually pretrial motions can be cliffhangers, but I'm not sure I know how to make them cliffhangers when it's not actually your case, you know, when you're reading about it in the context of fiction. So you have to pick and choose your way through and think, stand outside your own experience and say, okay, wait a minute, this is fiction. People are going to read it, you know, and they're not going to be sitting there in the middle of it going, it's my family member who just passed away and she's really litigating a case that's going to, you know, affect me personally. It's a work of fiction. So what would be intriguing and what wouldn't be? You have to weed it out. The one thing that I thought is seldom talked about, but I think can be and I hopefully did deliver, is jury selection. You don't see people talk about it very much, but that to me is the biggest heart pounder usually in a case, because number one thing is you have no control over the pool of jurors that are brought to court. They are randomly selected, so they say, and they come in. You may have a whole bunch of not so wonderful choices to choose from, and that's in itself an issue. So you have the pool you have, and then luck of the draw depends on, you know, which ones find themselves being excused. Some of your best jurors may be walking out the door because they're too honest. They admit they can't be fair, and or they have hardship. They're gone. So dealing with all of that and the kind of sword play you get into with the defense attorney over who you want versus who they want. So I did try to deliver that, the tension and the if you will, the highs and the very, very lows of jury selection, as well as then, of course, the courtroom drama of how your witnesses perform, how unexpectedly they fall flat on their face, unexpectedly they come through with flying colors, and all of the twists and turns that actually can happen. It's pulled out a little bit, of course, because it's fiction, but in large part the way I talk about it is the way things really would go, and hopefully with lots of suspense.
So real quick to finish it up, what is the future here for Rachel Knight and Marcia Clark going forward? How long, I mean, you're having a lot of fun doing this, so, and I know that you're going to have more books coming, so what is the future for Rachel Knight and Marcia Clark?
The future for us is more in different crime. Always the case will change, but you'll have the dynamics between her and her best friends and their boyfriends, all of their respective boyfriends, developing and changing as life really does happen. You know, people break up and people come back together and people meet new people, and all of that's going to happen to the character. So there will be personal development and stories as well as the case of the moment, which will be different in every book, and hopefully new situations. Some of them maybe in book four, the competition is a little bit ripped from headlines to talk about current issues of the day. Sometimes I'll be doing that, sometimes not. But overall, it's going to be Rachel and her buddies crushing crime together.
So that's the good thing, is that we're going to definitely see a lot more of Rachel, a lot more of Marcia going forward here in the near, who knows how long, until whenever.
Until whenever. And hopefully, you know, continue to, I hope that in all of my books I get to incorporate my life experience, you know, in the courtroom, so that there's a verisimilitude to it, so you have the sense that, you know, it is pulled out for fiction, but in general you get a real sense of how things really go in trial and in an investigation, so that there's a sense of learning something as well as having a good time.
Well, Marcia, we want to thank you so much for coming on today, and we know that your schedule is always so busy to talk about Killer Ambition Book 3 in the Rachel Knight series, so you have a wonderful time, and we will catch up with you again when Book 4 or anything else you just want to talk about, you just let us know, and we're glad to have you on.
Thank you, John. It's always, always such a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye, Marcia. Enjoy yourself.
Bye-bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Marcia Clark, and it's MarciaClarkBooks.com to find out a lot more information about the Rachel Knight series, especially now Book 3, Killer Ambition. And you can find that now wherever books are sold, and a lot more about the series if you're just finding out about Rachel Knight and the whole series. You can go back to Guilt by Association, then Guilt by Degree, and now Killer Ambition moving forward. And we just want to thank Marcia again for joining us. It's always a pleasure to have her on. We are going to be back here with our next guest. His name is author Paul Parsons, and he's going to be delivering you his idea and of intrigue and suspense and thriller going forward. So we will be right back on with him. And we will see you soon. I'd like to welcome you back, everybody, here to the halfway point, and what's been a fabulous show here on Suspense Radio. We had on first New York Times bestselling author Steve Barry talking about The King's Deception, and we just had on author Marcia Clark to talk about her book 3 and her Rachel Knight series called Killer Ambition. We are now moving here now to our next author. He is the author of the series, which is called the Baden-Powell B series. This is book 2, which is now out, and his name is Paul Parsons, and it's pauldparsons.com is his website. It's called London Beads Now, book 2. So we want to thank Paul to the show. Paul, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John.
So again, so your Baden-Powell Beads series here, it is now in book 2, with book 1 being called Baden-Powell Beads, and now you've kind of moved it into London Beads in book 2. So give everybody a little bit about the series, maybe going back and now into London Beads, that are just finding out about you, that are trying to learn more about what you know, about who your characters and what your series is about.
Sure. The fun thing for me is these beads are real. The series of books is a historical fiction thriller series, but the beads are real. What grabbed my attention was Baden-Powell was a historical figure in the late 1800s, early 1900s in England. And in South Africa, he found these beads, brought them back to England with him, and 30 years later gave them to the first Boy Scouts. He's the founder of the Boy Scout movement. So what fascinated me about the whole thing was he found these beads in South Africa. 30 years later, he gives them out. They are so precious to the Zulus that 100 years later, they find 4 of the original beads and give them back to the granddaughter of the Zulu chieftain. So as I was reading this history about Baden-Powell and these beads and the fact that they exist now around the world, I thought, wow, what I need is a Zulu that wants them all back for whatever reason, and this story will write itself. And that was book 1, essentially. Book 2 takes us into to London, where the distribution of the beads originated. Book 1, we're in Memphis, Tennessee, with the readers becoming acquainted with the the beads, the power of the beads, why and who wants them, for what reason. And then we have to, the story progresses into London, taking our characters with it.
And so now kind of when you're bringing them back and you're working into the series in book two, and you're going to have, I believe, four books in the series, correct? So you kind of already know. Yeah, so you already know. So when you're writing a series like that, knowing you only have, you know, four books into it, how is your process when you start working on, like, with the first one, Baden Powell's Beads, with your kind of with your pacing and making sure that you are, you know, bringing everything kind of along and now working it now with book two, which, of course, people will find out a lot more and you start revealing a lot more. How is your pacing? How has that kind of been when you move through all that?
Sure. That's the fun part for me, is this was not meant to be a series of four books. This was meant to be one book describing the mystery of the beads, and it was going to wrap up with the Zulu characters in Memphis. But as I researched them and found out more about these real beads and what they're made out of and where they came from, it tied in to other facts of African history, religious history, human history, and it was too good to let go. The characters were... the main characters are in book one is the doctor in Memphis, an orthopedic resident, and then the two principal characters that follow the beads through all four books are two Homeland Security agents. So as the story developed, as I was writing book one, books two, three, and four just came about. They evolved. I needed that much time to tell the story. The fun part for me was, as I discovered these, this took 4 years to do, and as I was discovering these things, the story fell together, which makes it exciting for me to combine the real aspects of the story of the beads with the fictional characters and the story I spun around it.
And when you stumbled across the story of these beads and the historical value and that they possess, and also just the mystery that surrounds them, what was kind of the one thing that kind of intrigued you to sit there and just go, you know, this is something that needs to be, you know, taught and shared with many more people? Because, quite frankly, I'd never heard of them before until, you know, seeing your series.
Yeah, that was the... I've noticed them now more myself now that I've gotten into this. They are, if you attend... scouting meetings of some sort, or just around scouts at all, you'll see some of the older scoutmasters with these beads hanging around their necks, which meant nothing to me prior to researching this story. The thing that really grabbed my attention here is I do a lot of reading myself and love historical fiction. What grabbed me with this was the beads are made out of acacia wood. The real ones, the ones that came from South Africa. Well, acacia wood is also known as shittim wood in the Book of Exodus. And according to Bezalel in the Book of Exodus, the Ark of the Covenant is also made out of this shittim or acacia wood.
Oh.
And I thought, oh my goodness, I got these beads in South Africa made out of acacia wood. You got the Ark of the Covenant, which originated in Egypt or in North Africa somewhere and may still be in North Africa somewhere. All I need is a connection between these two. And that was, there is a connection. There was a trader this shows up in book two, a trader in the mid-1800s in North Africa that wanted to look for a land route from North Africa to South Africa for trading of ivory and slaves and gold and whatnot. Right at the time, I needed him to be there to take the... beads from North Africa to South Africa, where the Zulus would come in possession of them. Now, that's that trader's real. The path is real. The beads going from North Africa to South Africa is fiction. That's something I created, but
okay.
It tied in so well, though, to create this story.
Now, when you mentioned, like, this was fact and this was fiction, and do you kind of let the reader know, hey, this is something that I kind of made up, but this is all based off of real life events, but I kind of, you know, fictionalized it to make it more interesting. Do you kind of let them know, you know, these kinds of things that are going on within your books?
Yeah, I include a fact versus fiction page, at the end of the book, which makes it more interesting to, I think, the reader to find out what that some of this is true, that I just didn't sit down and make all this stuff up. And then I run into the problem that all historical fiction writers run into. I figure my job as a writer is to tell a good story first, to entertain the reader.
Right.
To tie in history is fun. But sometimes, I mean, the reality is Baden-Powell found these beads in 1888 in South Africa just laying out in the field somewhere. Not interesting. I had to put him in a battle scene finding these beads on the Zulu chieftain that he just conquered in battle, which is fiction. That's not fact.
Right.
There are people that that are real sticklers for history, and I've run into a few of those that just that know the facts of the Boer War and know when the battles were fought and when they weren't. And I had to choose: was I going to stick to the reality of him finding the beads in 1888 when the Boer War wasn't really happening, or not? And I chose to
right.
tell a good story rather than to be exactly factually right with it. So yes, I do tell the reader at the end of the books what's fact and what's fiction, so they can kind of sort it out.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of the history stuff is, I mean, a lot of it is kind of bland. I mean, it's just not like the way that we want it to be. You know, when we kind of read these books and see that we have to make them a little bit more interesting. But the fact is that the mystery that surrounds the actual beads themselves is the intriguing part about what you're doing around these books and how everything is going to kind of fall itself into place. And I think that that's the biggest mystery that you're trying to get to the readers. And so the readers that are reading book one and that they finished and now leading on to book two, what's kind of the response that you receive from them? Because this is kind of all new to you. You know, you're just kind of jumping into the realm here. How has everything kind of been? How is the response kind of been? It's probably a little bit different than what you might have thought, because readers always tend to pick out the one thing that you're like, wow, I had no idea they were going to focus on that part.
Sure. Yeah, there are two groups. There are the groups that know the history, that know about the beads, that know the scouting history, which is, that's a small group of people, but they're there, they're real. They like this story because it's exposing a part of history that most Americans don't know about. In Scotland, in England, they know this story, not the fictional part, of course, but they know the real part. They know about the Zulu beads. In America, we don't. We just don't know this story. The biggest response I've gotten, however, are from the readers that really don't know the story and got caught up in it. And the idea that these beads are real. When I give talks, I'm wearing them. I have them, you know, in my possession and some silver casts made of the original beads that somebody had the presence of mind to make, 100 years ago or so. That just, I think, brings an element of realism to this mysterious tale that's being told that I think fascinates people.
And since because on your website, you know, you have a blog that talks about the odyssey of a first-time author and you kind of weaving your way through this fun, exciting, wonderful world of publishing.
Yeah.
because it's just so exciting every day. When you decided
right.
and you got, yeah, you know, it is, and I would tell people that too, but I lie. But so when you get in here and you're writing book one, The Baden-Powell's Beads, and you start putting yourself out there, just from an emotional, personal standpoint, how was it and how maybe nervous were you, or how much anxiety did you have to see how fans would react kind of to it?
No, that's very perceptive. My first book was not Baden-Powell's Beads. What authors will tell you, or what they've told me, is go ahead and write your first book, pour your heart into it, throw it away, and write your second book. My first book was the mandatory medical thriller that doctors have to write, and from that came two characters that were too good to let go, and I had to bring them into the bead series. But you're right, with that first book, when you throw it out there to the public, it really feels like you're walking outside with your pants down. You're just exposed, and you don't you don't know what's going to be coming at you. And you build a thick skin to that, where actually where you enjoy it, where you enjoy the exposure, and or at least I do, and the vulnerability that comes with laying yourself out there for people to experience. And the feedback's been great along those lines. So that's spurred me on. I mean, I guess part of the vulnerability of it is part of the attraction of it.
And now, do you have kind of any superstitions when you write, anything that you do all the time? Because a lot of writers tend to fall themselves into creatures of habit. So,
yeah.
You know, do you have any of those kind of superstitions or any of those habits that you fall into?
I don't know if they're superstitions necessarily. Habits, yes. I think habits are mandatory. Most of us have other lives besides writers that you have to work writing into. So I carve out a section of my life that is for writing. I do it from 4:30 in the morning to 6 o'clock in the morning every day, whether something happens or not.
Wow.
I mean, I'm just at the desk. I'm there in front of my computer every day for that hour and a half. A writer taught me very early on that a good day of writing is you sit in front of your computer for an hour and a half and nothing happens. Well, you needed that time. You were there. You showed up. Yeah, you were at work. And that has helped me. You don't feel frustrated when you have a bad day. My habit is, it's not necessarily superstition, but a habit is I show up. I just go to work every day from 4:30 to 6 and write. And that works.
Yeah, and that's all. And I think that's important because it gets you into that realm where you keep writing and you keep writing, and eventually, you know, is this something that you are going to do full time? Because you know, is that your goal to kind of, you just want to be an author and you're able to just kind of do this full time?
Sure. My in real life, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. That eats
mm-hmm.
up a lot of time during the
right.
daylight hours, and there'll come a time when I can't or don't choose to do that. Now, the writing and reading part, as long as my brain is functioning, I want to do that. That's fun. The writing is reading has been fun for me my whole life. I didn't realize how much fun writing and creating a story would be till I got into it. That's something I'd like to do forever and full time eventually.
And again, we're speaking here with author Paul Parsons, and it's pauldparsons.com is his website. And the series is the Baden-Powell's Bee series. We're in book two called London Bee. And when you go ahead and you look further, you can always see that you have the next couple books named. So where is the series headed now in three and into four? Because you probably already have them kind of written in some fashion or form already. So what can you kind of tell the reader moving forward now, moving to books three and four?
Yeah, books three and four are done. The titles will change. The cover art will probably change from what's on the website. The titles will change for sure, but the books are done. They've been through several series of edits. What I have found is I found an editor that I love that goes back and rereads previous stuff before we edit the next one, and she's been great with not only copy editing but content editing. It will
right.
draw my attention to things where I've let the tension slack where I shouldn't have. So the stories, though they are written, I'm sure they're going to change a little bit, but I doubt the substance of the story is going to change. How book four ended flabbergasted me. I was the writer of it, but I had no idea it was going to end like it did. It surprised me, so I figured it would surprise the readers also. And I suspect that will remain unchanged.
And are you going to be taking them more around the world, to different countries, different places, introducing them to a lot more of the history behind, you know, the bees and how this is more of a worldwide, I guess, mystery that people might not know too much about?
Sure. It ties taking the real history of the bees, the fictional history that I've developed with it, it ends up being a story of, mankind. I mean, from the beginning of recorded history to present day, and that now it sounds short. I mean, saying something like that, to have to do that in just four books, that sounds sort of short. But it really
yeah.
does tie in pieces of history that that otherwise you might not tie together. So it's I take the reader on journeys to not only different countries, but different aspects of humanity, I guess, which and I think that makes it for a fun story for the it made a fun story for me to write, and I think it makes it a real fun story for the reader.
And have you already started falling in love with some characters and secondary ones that you kind of put off to the side and written down their names? Has been like, you know what, I think I might want to explore them further after the series is over and maybe create something with them?
Oh, yeah. There's one character in the beginning of book two that was really a throwaway character. I brought him in order to introduce the two main characters, Patrick Darkson and Adnan Fazee for the Homeland Security agents. I brought this other character in to introduce them, and it's a mangled, beat-up vet of foreign wars who they have to keep locked up in D.C., and they bring him out every now and then to physically combat agents as they get ready to go out into the field just to see how tough they are. This was just a throwaway character to me, but the editor came back and said, oh, no, this you got to go back and do more with this one. So, and I think she's right. There's that character's too rich with the past I haven't even developed for him yet. So that yes, that character has a lot of potential. And the main characters in the series, most of them survive and make it through to book four. So they're still out there. They can there can be more than just the four books in this series.
And what's been like your biggest challenge, seeing as how, you know, this is kind of a series that is brand new to you, you're, you know, kind of like your debut series going out there? What was your biggest challenge, maybe, you know, not just starting the series, but now kind of progressing through, that you've had to work, you know, through, that other authors might be experiencing the same thing? Because we get a lot of authors that listen to the show because they love to hear, you know, other authors' stories and kind of the things that they've overcome. So what have you been able to overcome and your biggest challenges?
Wow, that's a good question. The biggest challenge probably is to keep it. You tend to want to get involved in your writing and to get, you know, maybe too much of a writer thrown into the story rather than to be an entertainer. And to me, I want to keep the reader entertained. I don't want to impress them with my writing or impress myself with my writing. I want this to be something that they turn the pages on, something that's like a movie, something that can be just from scene to scene to scene to keep going with it and not to get bogged down. And I find myself, I guess all writers do, you tend to get bogged down sometimes, and I will not let that happen. This has to keep moving. The story has to keep moving, and it has to remain exciting.
And so, what authors do you read, you know, kind of on a basis or that in the past that kind of gave you that, you know, that push to be like, I want to be into this world, and this is something that I want to do because I just love reading, you know, who these people are and these stories that are out there. So who do you kind of read?
Yeah, there's a couple of them. There's one that we just lost last week, Vince Flynn.
Yeah.
I mean, what a tragedy. I met him, and he actually worked with me on the first book, Baden-Powell's Beads. His story of becoming a writer is a fascinating one, and he has this great recurring character in Mitch Rapp that goes through all but his first in his series of books. He was a big inspiration to me in how he developed these stories, tied in realism, had interesting characters that he played with. I miss him. I mean, he died Thursday at age 47, which is a tragedy. The other biggest influence in my writing was a South African writer, Wilbur Smith, who wrote he's written probably 30, 35 books, in which he does I've learned so much South African history and world history by reading his fictional books, and been entertained while I was reading them with great characters. And that's what I've tried to do in my writing, is what he did in his, is entertain the reader, but at the same time you're educating them about history.
Yeah,
probably.
And it was... Yeah, go ahead.
And if there was a third one, it would have to be James Michener. I still refer back to Michener's book, The Source, was a book that I go back to pull pieces of history that he's uncovered and put in his books. He's I've collected and have the Michener Library here at home that I use as a reference source. So those are my three biggest influences.
Yeah, it was very sad when we heard the news of events, of course. We were able to interview him a couple of years ago back, and he was a great Minnesota guy, and we were from Minnesota, we had lived in Minnesota, so it was good to talk about stuff like that, and he was such a gracious guy that he will definitely be missed. And the thing about authors are, at least, just because they have passed on, their works are always there for history, for people to enjoy. And, 30, 40, 50 years down the road, people will still be enjoying Vince Flynn books, and that's always a good thing.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. So, what kind of events and things are you starting to do now that you're starting to get more immersed into the world with the fans and the publishing and, readers? Where are you going to be? Are you going on tour? Where can maybe people meet you? Or, what's kind of the contact that, you have with them and you answer questions from your fans? How's the interaction go?
What I'm doing now, I'm discovering what the best venues are and what aren't. As I was early in the game, I figured, well, naturally the places you want to go are the big bookstores and do book signings there. Yes,
nope.
You do have
nope.
to do that, but no. No, that's
no.
not.
I could have saved you a lot of time and said nope.
Well, you're exactly right. That's been unproductive, and it's not fun. I mean, even the ones that were good signings, they weren't really fun. The ones that are the most fun for me are the local book clubs that are very active, that have been around for a while, that have 50 to 100 members. All of them are readers. All of them read your books, have great questions, are your own little PR army that's out there in the community that talk you up. Those are my favorite groups to meet with. So when people here call me and say, can you come to Dallas for my book club, the answer is always yes. So that's what I'm doing now is networking with book clubs around the country.
Yeah, I think it's kind of neat to maybe go into like your local bookstore, whether it's a Barnes & Noble or an independent, and kind of have a book launching party where you can kind of have your friends and your families and some readers and things there. But yeah, authors, I mean, unless you are just a massively huge name, you're just not going to get numbers, and you're going to be sitting there for a long time. And it's just not fun. It's just not fun at all. I mean, and that's why I love the virtual tours and the virtual blog tours and things, because you're reading a lot more people. And I love the book club stuff. And, what's one of the experiences that you've had with the book club people?
Well, just last week I met here with a local group here in Middle Tennessee that they had a big luncheon. It's a fundraiser-type thing. They had three authors there that were speaking. Goodness, what an enthusiastic group. They filled up an auditorium at one of our local country clubs here with energetic, enthusiastic people that know me from different phases of life. And it was very active as far as book sales and PR for the book. That was those have all been like that. Every community I've gone to where I've met with that community's group of readers has been rewarding.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, Paul, we want to thank you so much for coming on and introducing us to the series, the Baden-Powell Beads series that you have going on, and just a lot more of your work. And again, we want to thank you for coming on, and we wish you nothing but success in the future. And so when you got books 3 and 4 and you're starting to go around again, give us a call. Let us know. We can see how the series is going on and how it's progressing.
I'll keep you informed, John. This has been great.
All right. Thanks a lot, Paul. Enjoy yourself and have a good one.
Thank you. You too.
All right, bye-bye. So again, everybody, that is author Paul D. Parsons, and it's pauldparsons.com and his website. He is on book two now, London Beads, the second book in his Baden-Powell Beads series, a fascinating mystery thriller wrapped up here. So it's something that I think you should want to definitely go and check out. And we're in book two of a four-book series, so you can jump right in and just get on going. And that's something that, you know, for summertime, you got nothing better than that. We are going to be back here with our last guest. We've had him on before. His latest book is called Green Light for Murder, and it is, you know, writer, producer, Hollywood extraordinaire, and author, great Haywood Gould is going to be on to talk about his latest book, and we will be back in just about 5 minutes.
I can feel no sense of measure, no illusion as we take refuge in young man's pleasure, breaking down the dreams we make real.
Suspense Radio has been a fabulous show. We're so glad that you guys could join us wherever you're listening to us, whenever you're listening to us, because remember, all shows are live and then available for on-demand as soon as the show ends, so you can put it onto your, you know, iPod, podcast, iPhone, whatever you have or whatever you want to listen to. We are there for you. And again, we want to thank all the authors for coming on, and we want to thank here our last author of the day. We've been on before, and he is back here with his next book called Green Light for Murder. He is author Haywood Gould. And Haywood, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, so we're moving along here. We were just talking a little off air where this next book in the Tommy Vesey mystery series, Green Light for Murder, you kind of use a lot of real world experiences that you have done. So tell us a little bit about the book, that might not be on the back cover, so people can kind of understand where you're coming from.
Well, it's kind of a perverted love letter to L.A. I didn't realize that's what it was until I finished it. I spent about 22 years out there living there in the movie business and collected a lot of crazy, you know, interesting acquaintances and lived through a lot of crazy experiences. And a lot of them, you know, come out in this book. And in addition, it's the beginning of a series about a homicide detective in Santa Monica, which is not called Santa Monica. The book is called La Playita. And I'm having fun writing about L.A. now that I don't live there anymore. It takes a while when you go to...
Go ahead.
It takes a while when you go to... When you live in a place to kind of figure out what it is and what's going on with it. It took me about 20 years and you know, to start to understand this new place that I live in, because they came from New York City, and it's very different in L.A. But now I think I kind of got a handle on it, and so I'm writing about it.
And so this is a new series with Detective Tommy Vesey. And so what kind of made you, you know, start bringing, like we said, like some of those skeletons out of those closets, and you figured that Tommy was the right character to be able to, you know, get your series off to the start?
Well, there's a craziness about what goes on in the movie business and the television business in L.A., and that kind of informs the whole place. There's kind of a craziness and a loopiness about what goes on in L.A. in general. I think that comes from the movie business. You have a collection of people, I would say probably millions, who all wanted to make the perfect movie. They wanted to be involved in the great movie, in the great television show, and they all came out to L.A. And now they're floating around in various jobs, various stages of life, some disappointed, some not, some frustrated. And it makes for an interesting, you know, kind of group of people. And because they all came out with dreams, me included. I wanted to make the perfect movie. I wanted to be that guy. I'd seen enough movies, you know, that I considered to be perfect, and I wanted to be in that mold. So, and everybody I met, no matter what they ended up doing in their lives, whether they were caterers or truck drivers or anything else in the movie business, had pretty much started out, you know, to be great filmmakers or great actors or actresses. So it was an interesting world out there. I mean, I found it to be.
Yeah, and the one thing that stands out, of course, is the story that's kind of within the story is like your villain that's within the story,
yeah.
kind of like your protagonist. Yeah, I kind of a very unique character. I mean, so explain a little bit about, I mean, because very unique, I guess, is just the word that I can explain. Until people read the book, they're going to understand what I mean by that. But can you give us a little bit more in depth into that character, because he's one of the most, I mean, uniquely characters I think I've ever read.
He's a he's a washed up movie television director off his meds, who's completely crazy. He thinks he's making a movie. The crew's in his head. He's going around town directing scenes, talking to himself pretty much, but the crew might be in his head and the movie might be imaginary, but the murders he's committing are real. He's committing, he's murdering people he feels, you know, screwed up his career somewhere along the way. And the only person who thinks that there's a pattern in this is Tommy Vesey, the detective, Santa Monica homicide police detective. He thinks he sees a pattern in these deaths that keep occurring over a period of time, and no one else kind of agrees with him until the end. So he's a crazy kind of wacky guy who's had a lot of failure and has been kind of in mental institutions. He's a guy who was very successful at one point and had a fall from grace, which happens a lot in the movie business. And now he's running around town, you know. It's kind of a hard thing to articulate. But like I say, he's making a movie in his head, but the murders are real.
And for people who aren't really familiar with L.A., I'm just going to let them know because, you know, I live in L.A. and I work in Santa Monica. You know, the first time you heard about Santa Monica when I was growing up was Three's Company, the Regal Beagle and everything else. And it really hasn't changed too much except it's extremely rich. I mean, there's a lot of money and that is in Santa Monica. I mean, it's one of the richest suburbs of Los Angeles. So for these things to be happening in a community like this, what made you pick Santa Monica besides maybe like a Venice or some other community where this might not have been, so surprising? Was it because of that aspect that Santa Monica was the perfect place to put this?
Well, Santa Monica, you know, it is a small city, but it's a very interesting city because it combines a lot of different elements. You have your very, very wealthy people, super wealthy these days, even wealthier now than they ever were when I lived there. But you also have a very urban area with a lot of undocumented people. You have the beach area, which is for tourists and attracts a lot of people. So it's kind of like, it's got some grit to it. It's got some glitz to it. It's got almost everything going for it in a very, very small geographical area. So if you're a cop there, you cover a lot of different stories. You'll get the rich, the white-collar crimes and all the crimes of wealth, and you'll also get the gang shootings. You'll get the drug trade. You get a lot of different stuff in Santa Monica, which in itself is a small place.
Yeah, and so... So you sat there, and when you were devising the place to put it, just Santa Monica was just another place that was just kind of close to you that you felt that this is where it kind of needed to be, and Tommy was going to be, you know, the detective that was going to be the perfect person to run with the story, Green Light for Murder.
Yeah, well, I lived in Santa Monica. I lived there for 22 years, and my kids went to school there. They went to public school there, and there were all kinds of people in that school. So they had a complete experience. They had an urban experience in Santa Monica, very much like the experience I had living in New York, in Brooklyn, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, because of all different kinds of people there. So I found it to be a very, very diverse place, and a very interesting place, I must say, you know, so that's where I set it. And it's a place where if you're doing a police story, almost any kind of a crime can take place within the environs of Santa Monica and make sense because all different kinds of people live there, as I said before, and many different kinds of crime are committed there. So if you want to do a police, you know, series, you can find yourself with a lot of different subjects, and they make sense in the context of Santa Monica.
Yeah, and that's definitely true. And the one thing that people notice when there's a lot of tourists, because they always seem to come around the road full time, is you know, you'll see there's a lot of homeless people that are also out and walking around, and a lot of people might be shocked at that to see in such a community that is, but it is very diverse. And speaking of kind of a very diverse character is your detective, Tommy Vesey. So give it, you know, so for people that are just kind of finding out, you know, what can you tell them about Tommy that, you know, is something that, you know, like the creation of him, because now he's going to be your character going forward, and people love to try to find that connection with those main characters. So what can you tell us about Tommy that might not be, you know, within the pages just as a creation of the character?
Well, he's a burnt out guy. He's a guy who couldn't solve a child murder. He's a guy who was a star policeman, cracked every case, cleared every case, that he was given, but couldn't solve this one. And it was a murder of a child, and then it really got to him. And he broke down. He had to leave the job. He was given, he was put into therapy. He was put on a medical, and he was allowed to smoke pot, which I noticed. as a therapeutic, you know, measure, he was prescribed marijuana. And now that he's back on a job, he's still doing it. So he's also, when he went to therapy, the only therapy that worked for him was poetry therapy. He was given a course in poetry, and he was told to express his feelings in rhyme and poetry. He scoffed at it at first, but then he started to do it, and it did help him. It did help him get through the nights. It helped him get through the nightmares of not being able to find this terrible child murderer, and he has continued doing that too. So he's kind of an oddball in a small police force, but he's a star detective. He bumps heads with his boss all the time, who really wants to get rid of him because he's too crazy, and the boss suspects that he's still doing marijuana, and the boss also suspects that most of his guys are covering up for him, which they are. They know he's doing it. So, I mean, he's a guy who's burnt out, who's struggling to keep his sanity, and at the same time, is working on the job and performing. So with him, every day is a struggle just to stay sane and keep his nose to the grindstone.
Yeah, I mean, and the poetry therapy is something I'd never, ever heard of before in any kind of situation. I mean, that was just something. Yeah, I mean, how did you think of that one? I mean, I got to know how you thought of that one.
Did you see it or did you just know someone
who did it?
Many years ago, I taught kind of a course back here in New York for people who've been, substance abuse and had committed minor crimes. And so I kind of taught a course with them, an informal course. And I don't know how it happened. I really can't remember, how it happened exactly. But I started bringing poetry into the class. And I remember I brought Emily Dickinson, of all people, into this class of tough, crazy guys, you know, and they responded. There's something about a poem. It's concise, and it's an expression of a person's feelings in a very concise form that you can immediately apprehend and understand. So, I thought, although I don't know if this is true or not, I thought that this would work for a character like VC as well. And I don't frankly even know if it worked for the guys I was, in this class with. But they did respond to the poems, and we did have long discussions about some of the poems that we were looking at. And so that was good. If it translated into making them feel any better about themselves, I don't know that. I can't to be honest. But in this case, Lisi kind of needs this. I think in poetry or in art in general, you recognize a kindred spirit, and it makes you feel less lonely in a way, even. For some drunken guy who beat up a guy in a subway to read a poem by Emily Dickinson about how lonely she is in Amherst, Massachusetts, it somehow seemed to click with people, and so it clicks, so it clicks with this character as well, with VC as well.
And again, I want to remind everybody we're speaking here with author Haywood Gould, and that's Haywood GOULD.com for the website to find out a lot more information about the book. Green Lights for Murder, along with all the things that you had done, because they'll see, writing and directing and many different shows, movies, TV, and a lot of other books that you wrote. So how do you see Tommy going forward now? I mean, do you you don't see really an end to the series. I mean, you don't have, the amount of books already planned out, do you? So this is just going to kind of be ongoing. So you have, a lot of ideas kind of running around your head, how you want Tommy to kind of go and, kind of progress through?
Yeah, I have two books kind of in the hopper now. One I'm working on right now and another one after that. And as long as the character seems fresh, as long as it makes sense, as long as I can come up with interesting stories, I'll keep the character going. As long as I can do it, as long as I feel, or the readers feel, even more important than me, feel that it's worthwhile, coming back to this guy. And so I kind of ended the first book with a question mark so I could go forward with some of the stories in the first book. I haven't resolved a couple of the issues in the first book. I'll try to resolve them in the second book. And I guess the idea is to keep things going and to always leave one strand of a story hanging so I can pick it up in the next book. And, it's the A story and the B story kind of technique. And so leave the B story hanging so I can resolve it in the next book. And that's what I did here. I left one story kind of unresolved.
Right. And kind of how, when readers kind of email you, what's kind of like the FAQ questions that you kind of always seem to get, from them that kind of surprise you, I guess, in a way, being the author and what they kind of pick out on their own that they find interesting?
Well, I mean, this book has had some interesting responses. You either really love it, and I'm glad that most people do, or you're really angry at it. And I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing.
No.
I mean, I've had people, who love the poems in the book, and there are people who hate the poems in the book. There are people who love the character, and there are people who are distressed by the character. They don't hate him. They're distressed by him. They're suffering along with him. They kind of don't like it, in a way. So I guess the readers, have to. But I mean, I've been getting you know, really great reviews. And they're on the website, obviously, because that's what the website's all about. It's about bragging about yourself,
yeah.
Which is kind of a weird thing, you know, to find yourself doing, but everybody does it, so I do it too. And it's been an interesting it's been an interesting response. Most of the stuff I've done, you know, throughout, I mean, almost everything I've done has gotten people who are really, you know, with me, and some people who really are angry at me. And this has gone on through the entire, you know, all the stuff I've ever written. I've always caused, you know, this kind of controversy, and I guess I always will. And so that's okay, you know, I mean, I accept it. And I'm just glad that people are interested in it and that they're reading the book to the end. I mean, all I really care about is that they're interested, that the book keeps them going. Their responses to it, are going to vary.
Right.
You know, but my job as an author is to make the book interesting and readable and make it compelling. And I think I've done that with this because everybody seems to have come to the end of it anyway, you know. And, you know,
yeah.
And there are a lot of comments. I've gotten a lot of comments on this book, a lot. Probably more than I ever got on any other book I ever wrote. People have really been interested. They've wanted to say things about the character. They've wanted to say things about the stories. They've wanted to say things about the milieu because what I'm portraying here is kind of like the dark side of the television business. It's the people who didn't really make it and they're working away in shows, syndicated shows, shows that, you know, will have a lifespan of a couple of seasons and then they'll go off the air. And what's going to happen to these people once the show is off the air? I mean, I experienced it myself. I have a lot of friends who went from making, and this is no exaggeration, who went from making millions to making nothing. Zero.
Wow.
With no chance. Oh, yeah. With no chance of ever making a dollar again. And who had established a lifestyle for themselves, obviously, you know, like a wealthy lifestyle, which then had to come to an end abruptly. I saw this happen a lot. So that's kind of who these people are portrayed as, you know, in the characters in the book are people like this who are coming to the end of a long-running TV series and looking to see what they're going to do next, if anything. So there's a whole aspect of the business that's new that seems to be interesting people as well. I guess I never thought of it. You know, everybody thinks of Hollywood as, you know, the glam, the splash, the big successes. But there's another side to it, too.
Yeah, I mean, and I think everybody has, you know, conversations. I know I have with friends of mine, and you start talking about a movie, and you're like, you know, God, whatever happened to that guy? Because you just never see him anymore. How come he's not making anything? And it is. It's like, yeah, like all of a sudden, like they just dropped off the face of the earth, and you just don't know what happened to them.
Exactly. That's exactly, you know, I mean, it's a pretty amazing. And these are people, you know, especially actors, maybe writers too, and directors, I guess, who when they have a little spurt of success, they think they're on their way, you know, and
yeah.
It's going to be this way. It's going to be this way forever, you know, and then it's not. And then they kind of sink
right.
into oblivion.
I mean, it's the same thing with athletes. I mean, athletes do the same thing. They think they're always going to make $20 million a year, and then 85% of them 7 years after they retire are bankrupt.
That's right. They're blowing their brains out. Right. They're depressed, and they're blowing their brains out in their houses, you know, and
right.
all kinds of crazy stuff. I know. It's the bitch goddess success, somebody once called it, the bitch goddess. And it is, you know. Look, I saw, I read an article the other day. It was Steven Spielberg and George Lucas were saying, the movie business is imploding. We can't get movies made anymore. I thought to myself, if Spielberg and Lucas are coming out now and saying they can't get a movie made, I mean,
jeez.
What's going on? Something, there's like a sea
yeah.
change. You know, something's going on. And
99.9% of America have no idea at all what goes on behind the scenes. But, of course, when you live in L.A. and you kind of know people and you hear the horror stories, you get a better sense of it.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
yeah.
It is. It's
wow.
People don't know what goes on behind the scenes at all. And it's kind of funny and interesting. I mean, I find it I always found it kind of funny. I found the guys I work with had a gallows humor, a black humor about themselves. You know, they kind of knew that, I mean, I always used to say, you know, I'm out here, you know, on a pass. In other words, I'm out here in L.A. and I'm working in the movie business. It's not going to last forever, and they're going to kick me out. I mean, that was my attitude. I didn't think, I never felt they were going to go on forever, you know, and I was, and I'm lucky I felt that way because it didn't go on forever. And it wasn't so bad for me, you know, when it stopped. But a lot of people are fooled and they're deluded into thinking they're on their way to stardom and success, you know, and it just doesn't work out that way for most people. Yeah, it's I once saw Anthony Quinn. It's another guy, a great movie actor. I once saw him on a TV show, and he was saying, what you do is you come out to Hollywood, you contribute, and then you leave. You know, and the business moves on, you know, the form, you know, moves on. You've done your bit, so to speak, and now you're out. And he said that. And, you know, he was like a major star. So yeah, these are the guys I'm writing about. And they have a kind of humor about themselves and about their situation that I found to be true. A lot of people who read the book have never been exposed to that side of the business before, so I'm getting a lot of response about that, you know, from people.
Yeah, I mean, that just is a lot more interesting to hear coming from someone like yourself. To hear, it's like more of the dark side, and for you to have to try to relive and experience that, you're going to get a lot of people that are just going to be like, wow, what the hell really goes on over there?
Yeah, that's what's happened. You know, it's now changing. So we're going to see what, you know, what emerges, you know, from this new kind of business. You know, what will it mean? What will it be? What will movies be like? What will the movie business be like? Because for people who go to the movies, there'll always be one there. You know, I mean, they may not want to see it, but it's changing. The culture is changing along with it, I think. You know.
I think that you kind of captured that within the book to kind of give that sense of really the changes and the things that are going on and how it really does affect people. Aside from them making millions of dollars, but I mean, it can be very emotional, very hard fall from grace.
Yeah, it is a hard fall from grace, and I used it in my last days in LA. I don't want to portray this somehow in some kind of medium. See people I knew just kind of driving around the streets, you know, just driving around in their cars. I mean, they have nothing to do. And they don't live in a city where they can, you know, go across the street and get a cup of coffee somewhere. So they're just driving around. And I would see them. We'd wave to each other, and they'd go on. And all these kind of lost souls. So I want to kind of portray that, you know. And so that's what I tried to do in this. And I'm working on some other things, too, in a similar vein, in the next book.
So now, since you're in New York, are you going to be at Thriller Fest in a couple of weeks?
Where's Thriller Fest?
Thriller Fest is by the – yeah, it's in New York. It's put on by the International Thriller Writers Association. So
yeah,
it's in New York. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there.
So I didn't know if you're going to be there or not. Yeah, because I was always trying to figure out – you know, I always like to let people know what's the best way for them to contact you, or can they meet you somewhere? Are you going to be out doing, you know, book signings or anything else? You know, how can fans – or people now that are just kind of getting to know, you know, your work, be able to maybe contact you and ask you questions? Where are you going to be at?
Well, I mean, I've been doing a lot of signings. I don't think I have one lined up. I did a bunch of signings. I did one in Atlanta, Nashville, I did Chicago. I did a bunch of signings. They were good. I guess I'll be at the ITW. I haven't I'll go. Yeah, I mean, I'll be there. And they can always email me or they can contact me through the webpage. I get a lot of stuff in the webpage. And they can just write me on my webpage. I always respond to to queries and to comments from people. And that's about it. I mean, I don't have anything planned right now.
Well,
the next book won't be out until probably next year, 2014. It's with Tyrus Books. Tyrus Books brings them out pretty quickly, so that's a good thing. If you get it into them and they like it, you know, they'll bring it out. you know, pretty quickly. So
yeah.
it's my job to finish it. And I'm, you know, just from a professional point of view, I realize now you have to write at least one or two books a year in order to build up, you know, enough response, enough audience. So that's what I'm trying to do, you know, right now. And so I'm working as hard as I can. But I'm a guy who looks at every period and every comma over and over again. So, you know.
Yeah, I got you. I mean, because the book business
is much
different than the movie business. You know, you can write a great book, and then all of a sudden you stop writing great books, and then you start falling from grace, too. So it's just not quite as hard and as noticeable, I guess you want to say.
Yeah, also, people give you – yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You're always at the mercy of the last thing you did, that's for sure. And so that's got to be good. And also, you yourself have to feel that you're getting better. You have to feel that you're making some kind of progress as a writer. You don't want to feel that you're just marching in place, you know, and just doing the same thing over and over again because it had a success the last time. So you want to keep trying to expand and experiment, and, you know, I mean, that's the challenge as a writer that you want to keep facing.
Right, and that's what, and I think that's one of the most important things that you can tell an author coming up is continually challenge yourself and don't get stuck in the same rut, because that'll make you much better going forward, maybe in the third book, in the fourth book, in the fifth book, that you just start seeing that progression.
Well, you have to challenge, and you have to develop your character as well. If you're doing a series, I mean, I think, if you're doing a series, the character has to evolve too. Otherwise, at a certain point, the character becomes boring. And then it becomes kind of like a routine. And I know that people will pick the book up and they'll read it anyway, because it becomes a routine with them too, in a way. But you want to keep challenging the reader as well as yourself. So you want to develop the character, you want to develop yourself as a writer, you want to try new approaches. You know, I'm having a different narrative style in this book than I had the last time. And I'm just trying to, you know, and you take a chance. You take a chance because when you surprise people, you know, sometimes people are irritated when they get surprised by things. They respond in a way, they expected one thing, they get another. And, you know, some people don't like that, and some people do. So, but I feel that I have to keep, you know, forging ahead and trying to find new forms and new narrative structures within this form that I'm working in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what, Heywood, we want to thank you so much for coming on to talk about the first book in the Tom Kavisky series, you know, Green Light for Murder, and we are so excited to see what's going to come on in the future. So, hey, keep in touch with us, and we'll talk with you soon.
Okay, thanks a lot for having me, John.
All right, bye-bye. Enjoy.
Okay, bye.
So again, everybody, that is author Heywood Gould, and it's heywoodgould.com, G-O-U-L-D.com, to find out a lot more about the Tommy Vesey series, first book here, Green Light for Murder. It is a fabulous read and a fabulous insight into, you know, the behind the scenes that Heywood was just talking about. And we want to thank all of our authors that have been on today, starting with author Steve Barry on his book, The King's Deception, and then Marcia Clark with her third book, Killer Ambition, and in the Rachel Knight series, and then Paul D. Parsons, who with his Baden Powell Beach series and London Bees and the Heywood Gould. We got a lot of exciting stuff coming up. Remember, download the book West Palm from Simon Schuster. It's a fabulous read. Amon Kavachik with Blood on His Stage. You want to see real life stuff come to life, you get Amon Kavachik and you get his book Blood on the Stage. We got a lot of other things that are coming out. The book, the magazine's coming out in July, July the 5th around that time. We're going to be at Thriller Fest. If you're going to be there, say hi to us. And then we'll see you guys in about a month with the next radio show, and then things should start easing itself back out as soon as we kind of get over all these things that we got going on. We want to thank you guys all so much for all your support, and we will see you all on the road or on the radio or in the magazine. And until then, goodbye, everybody, and thanks again.